McCroskey Art Center in Grand Rapids hosts an opening reception for the group exhibit Expressing Grief, Friday, September 5th from 4 to 7 p.m. Five regional artists come together to honor the experience of grief in its many forms. Show your support for veterans at the 3rd Annual Meatloaf Run Motorcycle Ride this Saturday, September 6th. The ride, hosted by the Combat Veterans Motorcycle Association, and travels from Grand Rapids through Itasca and St. Louis counties, ending in Blackberry. The Virginia Area Historical Society's annual Fall Fest is Saturday, September 6th in the Lions Club building at Olcott Park, starting at 4 p.m. with grilled burgers and brats. The featured speaker is Mark Sage, who will talk about Frank Higgins, one of many sky pilots during the logging era. The Clearwater County History Center in Shevlin invites you to an open house for National Grandparents Day, Sunday, September 7th from 1 to 4. Enjoy a car show, wagon rides, and refreshments. You can make your own ice cream. Stages of the Range Players holds auditions for the ice fishing play September 8th and 9th from 4:30 to 6:30 at Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Virginia. The play was written by Minnesota storyteller Kevin Kling, and performance dates are in November. Now we'll take you back to Morning Edition here on member-supported KAXE-KBXE.
PR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A panel of the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals has blocked the Trump administration from using a wartime power to deport Venezuelans from three states. As NPR's Jimena Bustillo reports, that means the issue of President Trump's use of the Alien Enemies Act could wind up back at the Supreme Court.
The latest court decision blocks deportations with the use of the act from Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. Earlier this year, Trump invoked the 18th century wartime power to help streamline deportations of Venezuelans he says are members of the Tren de Aragua gang. Since then, the use of this power has attracted numerous legal challenges, including two prior Supreme Court decisions. But the High Court has yet to directly address the larger question of whether Trump's invocation of the Alien Enemies Act at all was legal. This preliminary injunction can now be appealed by the Trump administration to settle that bigger question. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump says he'll direct federal law enforcement intervention into Baltimore and Chicago.
Well, we're going in. I didn't say when. We're going in. When you lose, look, I have an obligation. This isn't a political thing. I have an obligation. When we lose, when 20 people are killed over the last 2.5 weeks.
But the mayors of the city say they don't want federal intervention. Trump has already sent National Guard troops into Los Angeles and has kept them in Washington, D.C. All of the city's mayors are Democrats, who are Black Americans. Yesterday, a federal judge ruled that Trump broke federal law by sending the National Guard to Los Angeles in June. This had followed days of protests against immigration raids. The judge ruled Trump's actions raise concerns that his administration is creating a national police force with the president as its chief. Two congressmen will hold a press conference this morning on the steps of the U.S. Capitol. They'll be joined by several women sexually assaulted by convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Some will tell their stories. Their press conference comes as the lawmakers are pushing for the release of more files on the Epstein investigation. NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports a House committee has started releasing thousands of pages from the case.
The Oversight Committee was in the middle of an investigation into the disgraced financier and convicted sex offender. The committee's already received files subpoenaed from the Justice Department. But some lawmakers are pushing for more public access to the files. Democrat Ro Khanna and Republican Thomas Massey are using a procedural maneuver in hopes of forcing a vote on the House floor that could compel the Justice Department to release the investigation files. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, the Capitol.
President Trump says U.S. forces have destroyed a boat off Venezuela. He says it was carrying drugs. Trump has deployed U.S. warships off the Venezuelan coast. The Trump administration accuses Venezuela's president of leading a drug cartel. He says the Trump administration is trying to overthrow that government. This is NPR. A federal judge in Texas is going to hear arguments today in a case involving aircraft maker Boeing. The Justice Department is seeking to drop conspiracy charges against the aircraft maker. This is in connection with two huge plane crashes of Boeing's 737 MAX jetliner. 346 people were killed, some off Indonesia and more in Ethiopia. Relatives of the victims are trying to stop the Justice Department from dropping the charges. Officials in some Minnesota cities are urging Governor Tim Walz to call a special legislative session. They're calling for a statewide ban on assault-style weapons. The governor is considering a state response to the mass shooting that killed two children at a Catholic school in Minneapolis. Minnesota Public Radio's Clay Masters reports.
The mayors of some of Minnesota's most populous cities are calling for a statewide ban on assault-style weapons. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey says if the state legislature doesn't pass a ban, it should let cities act.
We see the aftermath and how communities are broken apart by gun violence. We have the ability to change, and so give us the authority to do it. Change the law that preempts cities from acting if you are not able to do it yourselves.
Democrats have slim control of state government here in Minnesota. Some Republicans in the state legislature say city-by-city ordinances would intrude on gun rights. For NPR News, I'm Clay Masters in St. Paul.
Vice President Vance and Second Lady Usha Vance will be in Minneapolis today. They'll hold private meetings with victims of last week's church shooting and their families to pay respects. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Avalara, providing businesses with cloud-based tools and managed services for property tax compliance, from filing returns to tracking assessments. Learn more at avalara.com/property tax.
There are a lot of protections that the National Guard has with, like, say, our civilian jobs, which I've actually had to utilize for previous employers who didn't understand my military obligation.
This is Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served, a series exploring the challenges Minnesota's veterans face, as well as the opportunities and services available to them.
My name is Jodine Eels, and I'm a police officer on the civilian side, and then I'm also in the Minnesota National Guard. We have a lot of protections in place that I'm very thankful for and has relieved a lot of stress when it comes to my civilian job and my military service. I had never heard of ESGR before my deployment. So ESGR stands for Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve. ESGR came and did a brief for us, and I realized my employer was not following my rights. I reached out, I had called ESGR, and I said, can someone please help me? And it was one phone call, and they fixed everything for me.
Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served is produced by AMPERS with support from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, providing our veterans with help. Veterans can find that help online at minnesotaveteran.org.
Morning edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. In a few minutes, we'll hear from one of the women abused by Jeffrey Epstein. She is one of many here in Washington today who are pressing Congress to demand more information about the convicted sex offender.
This is the latest news story that is inconvenient for the White House. The president spent part of yesterday dismissing questions about a decline in his health, saying he was, quote, very active. Today, some members of Congress are trying to force a vote to make the Trump administration release the Epstein files. Trump's Justice Department first promised to release more information about Epstein and then abruptly said, move along, nothing to see here.
NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro is with us now to tell us more about all this. Good morning, Domenico.
Hey, good morning, Michelle.
So explain what these lawmakers are trying to do.
Well, the two members of Congress who are at the center of this effort are Republican Thomas Massey of Kentucky and Democrat Ro Khanna of California. Massey filed what's known as a discharge petition on Tuesday. That's a procedural maneuver to try and get around leadership and force a vote. They need 218 House members to sign it and force that vote. It would still need to pass the Senate, though, so this wouldn't force a release on its own. But proponents hope that this will ramp up political pressure on the administration to do more. To an extent, it's already having an effect. I mean, after the petition was filed, the Republican-controlled House Oversight Committee released some 30,000 more pages of documents related to the investigation. But a lot of that information is already public. It's not new. And those in favor of the release, of more release, are saying don't be fooled by that.
So what exactly do those calling for the full release of the files want or expect to find?
Well, I want to highlight how Ro Khanna describes what this effort and discharge petition are about here on Morning Edition on Tuesday.
The petition is about restoring trust in government. It protects victims' identity. It simply calling for the release of all of the Epstein files to hold rich and powerful men who abused underage girls accountable.
You know, more than this being about individual men who are Democrats or Republicans, this is seen as a question of who has power, money, and influence, and how it's used or abused. Very rarely have we ever seen Congress really involve itself in the Department of Justice and its investigations quite in this way.
You know what? We don't want to discount the fact that there are young women here who experience something terrible, okay? But how much of this pressure is really about political opportunity?
Politically, a day that's focused on Epstein is a day that is likely more helpful than not to Democrats. I mean, it's an irritant for Trump, especially since he's had a longtime friendship with Epstein. The White House says Trump and Epstein had a falling out in the early 2000s because Epstein was, quote, being a creep. Other reporting has said it was over a property dispute. Nonetheless, there's a lot we don't know about their relationship. The association is certainly something Democrats, though, don't mind reminding people about. And polling has shown big majorities of people don't think the government is being transparent enough and disapprove of how Trump is handling this.
Can you say more about that polling very briefly? Is this something that's resonating with voters?
You know, it's hard to say that this is going to be something that factors into people's minds more so than, say, prices, crime, or immigration. But that's not to say it doesn't matter to people. It's one of the rare areas where we've seen some splits with people who are key in Trump's base.
That is NPR's Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thank you.
You're welcome.
One of the women who planned to speak at the U.S. Capitol is Lisa Phillips. She has publicly told her story of being a young model lured to Epstein's private island more than 20 years ago. She now hosts a podcast interviewing other women on sex trafficking and grooming and related issues. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
I'm glad you've joined us. The question before Congress is a yes-no question, whether to release the files. What do you think might be in them?
Well, the files will contain personal emails from Jeffrey to his co-conspirators, also the videos that were taken from his many houses, especially the Upper East Side home. The townhouse had cameras everywhere, and the flight logs and the people that were going in and out of the island where many women were trafficked.
I'm interested that you say that in plural, co-conspirators. There is one person, of course, who has been convicted for the variety of crimes surrounding Epstein besides Epstein himself. You think there are more people who would fit in that category?
I mean, I know there's more people. There was many other powerful people involved. There were many enablers, and Jeffrey wasn't seeing many women every day for his own sexual gratification. He was seeing them and building this ring for other powerful men globally.
Did you feel that you were lured into not only being abused by him, but being set up to be abused by others?
Absolutely. At the time, when I knew him in the early 2000s, I did not know that or even have ever thought that. I didn't find out until I started speaking to other survivors after he died in 2019. And I started just being really confused, like, what happened to me back then? I didn't want to think about it, but you know, because everybody was talking about it, I reached out to other survivors, and we all have the same story. And then the grooming and the manipulation, I kind of didn't want to admit it because back then I thought of him as almost like a mentor or someone that was, you know, he's prominent in New York and everybody knew about him. Everybody kind of loved Jeffrey. I mean, he was mysterious. And then I started to really, when I was deposed for other cases and speaking out, I started to realize that, wait a second, I have some names that I was sent to, which I thought they were for, career moves or just relationship building. I was innocent back then, my thinking. And then I realized a lot of the men that I was sent to, many other women were sent to the same men. That's when I started to realize that I had been trafficked by Jeffrey Epstein.
When you use terms like grooming or manipulation, they seem really meaningful in your story as you've laid it out. This is not a violent assault. This is someone who says, come to an island and then come into a room and get involved in a massage, and then you're deeper and deeper involved.
Yeah, well, he's a master manipulator, and he's just the way he built his sex trafficking ring over so many years was just purely genius because he had other women and young women also bringing the girls. That's what happened to me. It was another young woman, you know, 21, 22 years old, that brought me over to the island from a photo shoot.
One thing that drives the public interest in this is the idea that there would be even more powerful and famous people implicated than all the powerful and famous people who've already been named in one way or another. Are you convinced that there would be more names if we knew everything?
But of course. That's the whole point of everything, was there other men. It wasn't just Jeffrey doing all of this. Jeffrey did this. He recorded everything to have things on other people, and which he did.
You believe this wasn't just about sex and influence, it was about extortion and blackmail?
Yes, of course, absolutely. I mean, for anyone to think it's just Jeffrey Epstein seeing hundreds of women just for his own gratification is ridiculous. No, there was every woman that came into his world that he brought in and trusted were sent to other men, whether they knew it or not, they know it now. And they were abused by many other powerful men, politicians, and people in the arts, entertainment, and sports.
Now, Mike Johnson, the House Speaker, has delayed this process somewhat over the summer and raised the concern of harm to victims, that releasing too much information would harm people like you. Now, you've decided to speak out, but there are a lot of women who were involved. Do you think it's possible that others could be hurt?
I don't think they care that much to say, oh, we're not releasing this because it's going to harm the victims. They're not releasing it because it's going to harm them and their friends and people.
Whatever their motivations are you concerned about women being harmed by further discussion of this or further revelations?
No, we're already being harmed because there's no accountability. There's no transparency. That's what harms us, is that the people that need to be held accountable aren't.
As you've made very clear in telling your story, you were used. You were manipulated by someone. And now you are in this political fight that is about Epstein, but seems to be about a lot more, and it's partisan and everything else. Are you concerned about being used by one party or by both at this moment?
That's a good question. I mean, for me, it's not a political issue or one side or the other. It's just a human rights issue, you know, to get justice. So I would say no to that question.
You don't think that you're being used or that you would be used?
I don't think so.
President Trump talked about the Epstein files. A number of people who worked for him promised release of the Epstein files, and then they changed course. And Trump himself seemed reluctant even during last year's campaign. He said, well, there might be innocent people who were just named in the files and it would be unfair to them. Not that you would know personally, but you've had time to think about it. Why do you think President Trump would be reluctant now to release these files?
I believe that President Trump is not releasing the files because he doesn't have the power to do so. I think that the people that are on the list are holding him back from doing so. I don't believe he's doing it out of personal reasons. I believe that he's protecting the people that are on the list.
I want to underline what you just said. And of course, you're telling us your belief. We don't know this from evidence, but you don't think his name is in there in some nefarious way, more than whatever we know. You think that other people are restraining the president of the United States. Is that right?
I think there's more powerful people on that list than President Trump, yes.
Lisa Phillips, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Lisa Phillips is an advocate for survivors of sexual abuse and trafficking and is the host of the podcast From Now On. We'll continue following this and other stories wherever they lead. We will also hear more points of view on your public radio station, which brings you Morning Edition. This is NPR News.
You are listening to Morning Edition here on the Wednesday Morning Show here on member-supported KAXE KBXE. My name is Andrew DeZingle. In just a bit, I'll be joined by Heather Johnson, and we'll be here until 9 o'clock. Then we're going to hand things over to Headwaters. Support for KAXE comes from The Sewing Room, hosting the Cultivating Community Summit, a two-day gathering of community members with events focused on equity, connection, and community resilience, taking place at the Geechee Zibi Center for the Arts in Brainerd, September 22nd and 23rd. More info at sewingroom.org. The Minnesota Department of Transportation has an open house Wednesday, September 10th at 5:30 about the Grand Rapids La Prairie Corridor Study. Meet at Yanmar Arena for a brief presentation, followed by an opportunity for questions and feedback. The Creative Spirit Fiber Arts Group will hold classes at Willowwood Market, just south of Bemidji, Saturday, September 13th, beginning at 10 a.m. Classes include felted bowls, basket making, Zen rock wrapping, and more. Pre-registration required. Learn more by searching for Willowwood Market on Facebook. Applications are now open for the University of Minnesota Extension Master Gardener Volunteer Program. Learn how to share science-based horticulture knowledge with people in your area. The course begins in January, and the deadline to apply is October 1st. To learn more, visit z.umn.edu or contact your local extension office.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Arm with the new podcast series, Tech Unheard. Arm CEO Renee Haas talks to tech company leaders who are working to help shape the future of computing. Available on all podcast platforms. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From RBC Wealth Management, where financial advisors work to understand individual goals and are dedicated to providing customized advice to help strengthen financial security. More at rbcwealthmanagement.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Ever since Arundhati Roy's writing made her famous after her first novel won her the Booker Prize nearly 30 years ago, she's used her words and her celebrity to write on injustice, minority rights, and the human condition. And that's been met with wrath and attempted censorship from the Hindu nationalist government in her native India. She's been found guilty of contempt by the country's Supreme Court and is currently facing prosecution for something she said over a decade ago under the country's anti-terrorism law. Her latest writing, though, is her most personal. It's about her mother, Mary Roy. She died 3 years ago, and Arundhati Roy had to grapple with why the loss of a parent she once ran away from hit her so hard. Her new memoir is Mother Mary Comes to Me. And when I spoke to her, I started by asking her to describe her mom, a woman she calls her gangster.
Well, it took me a whole book.
Yeah.
What it was a challenge to me as a writer.
Yeah.
Can you write this woman? Can you write a person who you really can't make up your mind about because she has such a spectrum of facets to her, you know?
Yeah.
And if I had to describe her, I'd say she was like an airport with no runways. You could never land.
I don't know that as anybody's child, we see our parent as a whole person, but you wrote about a whole person with her own traumas. She was this defender of women's rights. She builds a school with a cult following after leaving her husband and being shunned by her family and community. She creates a path for you to also speak up and defend against injustice, but she was awful to you. How did you write about her in this holistic way with her own traumas and demons?
I mean, now when I think of it, I think I was her mother, you know?
Mm.
Like, I was the one who continuously needed to try and understand her and why is she doing this or why is she saying that. Sometimes it was so tiring. As a child, I could see her fighting for the space for women. I admired that even then, even when I was the victim of her wrath and her anger and her resentment, I could somewhere see that it was because of what she was doing, and what she was doing was partly for me too, not because I was her daughter, but because I was a woman.
When your mother in the book passes away, you talk about being unanchored in the world. Does it still feel like this?
You know, I had to spend so much of my life trying to manage this relationship. And in order to manage it, I had to become a very strange shape. And when the reason for being that shape isn't there, why am I like this, you know?
Why am I shaped like this?
Yeah, because the reason for being shaped like this in this odd way has gone, but you're now shaped like this.
Yeah.
However harsh and cruel she was, I knew that it was worth that thing that I held on to, you know, that I do not want to ever defeat her.
Mm.
And I want her to go out like a queen. And so I thank the God of striped and spotted things that I did not defeat her.
Why didn't you? I mean, just in the sense that there were moments where she was so cruel to you, and the insult, and the moment that you ran away, it was to escape an abuse.
Yeah, but there was always that admiration too in me, you know?
Yeah.
There was always that part of me who said, wow, look what she's done.
And that's what's so incredible about your book, is that despite the cruelty that's described, you don't hate your mother. The reader doesn't hate your mother. They also are in awe of her and confused by, or at least I was.
Yes, yes. I think I just wanted you to feel like me.
The political situation in India is the background of your life story. And your book spans your whole life, but really politically we're from the 90s to almost present day. Is there a larger message here to other nations, including the U.S., that are watching the rise of populist fervent ideologies like Christian nationalism here?
Well, you know, honestly, I spent so much time thinking about the parallels. And India was politically in the place where the U.S. is now in 2014. We saw the attack on history books. The only big difference is that in India, the mainstream media has been entirely complicit with this.
You are such a known figure now, and your writing has gotten such acclaim. And that means a lot of public adoration, but also a lot of public abuse when you stand up for something that's not popular. But you write in your book that celebration of something you've done or that you're doing triggers a childhood fear, a moment where your brother was beaten over his grades in another room, and the next morning you were praised for good grades. And at the time, you wrote, on occasions where I'm toasted or applauded, I always feel that someone else, someone quiet, is being beaten in another room. Is that something you still feel?
But it's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, as we speak, it's true. People in Gaza are being beaten and starved. Wherever you look, things are happening, and you can't just think of your own story.
Yeah.
You know, it's my story is the story of so many people and so many things and so many circles of solidarity and suffering and so on. So it's not that I'm triggered or guilty or anything like that. It's just that I'm aware. I'm a person who's aware. It's awareness. It's not guilt, you know. It's just,
it's reality.
Yes, yes. You know, and that doesn't mean that we are sort of incapable of happiness or incapable of being glad that our work is appreciated, but how can you not be aware of what's going on?
Mm. Arundhati Roy's new book is Mother Mary Comes to Me. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is NPR News.
Today, median U.S. home prices are at a record high. You know what else is? The age of first-time homebuyers.
We'd make jokes like, what was I doing in third grade? I should have been buying a house instead of learning multiplication. Just because it's been so difficult.
How one state is pushing developers to build starter homes people can actually afford. On the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered later today at 4 o'clock with your local host, Jennifer Barr. You're tuned in to the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Andrew DeZingle here with Heather Johnson.
Good morning.
Good morning. So it is Wednesday morning, and it was a bit cool, I think, this morning. What do you think?
It feels like fall. It feels like back to school, and I kind of love it.
It's amazing how it is definitely, yeah, like you said, like as soon as school started, now it's time for a temperature to just drop immediately.
yeah, it definitely feels like, you know, getting your fresh new backpack and your new notebooks together and
new markers, perhaps.
New markers, yeah.
I was always excited to use those at the beginning of the school year.
Oh, yeah, or if you got, like, the cool erasers, like the ones that were, like, 80 cents instead of 15 or whatever. Yeah, I enjoyed those.
Where you would get every basketball team pencils.
Basketball sets? Team pencil sets.
Yeah.
That was not my jam.
What about football teams?
No, but, like, Lisa Frank. Which I don't think I ever got the Lisa Frank ones. Like, maybe if there was, like, a knockoff version, maybe I got that. The Fisa Link ones or something.
So, that's Heather Johnson. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We're your morning show crew here for the Wednesday morning show. And then we're here until 9 o'clock. Then we're going to hand things over to Headwaters. And I'll be going from 9 to 11. And then followed by that, the World Cafe.
Sounds like a great day.
Yeah, and we've got a live Area Voices coming up this morning. We are going to be talking with Steve Call, talking about the upcoming exhibit at the Tally Gallery at BSU, featuring Marley Call's artwork throughout the years, from some pieces as early as the 60s and some up to 2020. So it's a very wide range. That's 60 years.
Yeah. It's crazy. I peeked at that exhibit online, or some of the pieces in it online. I know you saw them in person, so
I
am very excited to learn more and to go see it in person myself.
Yes, it's a very interesting pieces. Like, the not only do they range from age of how long they've been around, but the various sizes of the pieces too, from the early days to the most current pieces are huge pieces.
Well, it's really interesting to look at a body of work that's that big, right? That expands that much time, because you can kind of see the person changing as well if you look at it in these different decades and, you know, phases of life and everything. So I love that.
Yeah. So cool. That exhibit will be opening tomorrow, and there's a artist or kind of an opening reception going on from 4 to 7 tomorrow as well at the BSU Tally Gallery. And so that'll be coming up this morning. And of course, we're going to be talking about all things Grand Rapids Riverfest, which is this Saturday. Can't believe it. Already September 6th this weekend. Where did the time go?
I don't know. It seems like we just announced it. So. I don't know what happened.
So, of course, this year we've got Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk this weekend, and tickets and info at grandrapidsriverfest.com. It'll be a little cooler this weekend, but I think that's just going to help, because you get to wear the jean jacket, you get to look cool. I got to wear a jean jacket for the Jason Isbell one. Felt very cool.
Oh, okay. So the jean jacket is like, it's like a confidence builder.
It's like the prime festival wearing outfit.
Really?
A jean jacket.
Geez, I didn't know. I wasn't planning on wearing mine.
Well, you should change your plans now.
Yeah, when it comes to comfortable garments, that's not the most comfortable thing in my closet.
Really?
No.
It doesn't give you that sense of, ooh, jeans.
No, you know what it makes me think of? It kind of makes me think of being a little kid, because you had, like, the jean jacket was the thing when I was a kid, so I wore one.
I have a jean jacket as a child. Yeah. I definitely had one of those, what's the...
Well, like a starter jacket?
Sort of. They're like the kind of, I can't describe
or
the
windbreaker?
Yeah, more of like a windbreaker jacket.
Sure, yeah, you had to have one of those too.
Yeah, the wind didn't stand a chance back in the 90s. The prime of windbreakers, some might say.
Some might.
But speaking of weather, today we have 40% chance of showers, mostly cloudy, highs 50 to 57 degrees, northwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with lows in the high 30s, northwest winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. And tomorrow, showers likely, mostly cloudy with highs near 55, northwest winds gusting higher, evening lows near 42.
We receive support from the Bonner Eye Clinic with locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, offering cataract surgery, LASIK, and general eye exams. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly.
Now it's time for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Studies show microplastics can be found throughout our ecosystem, and plastic pollution disproportionately impacts indigenous communities. So scientists at Alaska Pacific University in Anchorage are studying how these tiny particles of plastic move through Alaska water. And they're developing the first in-state lab accredited to test water samples for microplastics. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra reports.
Nike McCampbell pulls on her diving dry suit and walks to the edge of the water at Smitty's Cove in Whittier. She dives below the surface. McCampbell will travel underwater about 80 yards from shore to collect water samples. She says they're studying how microplastics are transported through ocean currents.
And we're going to see where microplastics are moving.
She's part of a new team at Alaska Pacific University. Last year, the APU team got a $5 million grant from NASA to study microplastics in Alaska. Microplastics have already been found in the most remote corners of the state. So APU's research aims to expand that understanding by looking at how microplastics enter all water sources, including oceans and rain. Kian Muldoon is a graduate student on the research team. He says the ultimate goal of their work is to help reduce the harmful health effects of microplastics.
Hopefully using that research to inform cleanup efforts or to try to mitigate harm.
Back at the APU lab, Muldoon and his colleagues can use new specialized equipment to help identify various microplastics in the samples. The team has already collected samples from the summit of Denali, the Aklutna Lake watershed, and Prince William Sound. That's according to Dr. Dee Barker, a chemist and head of the research team. She says with new instruments funded by the grant, the team can identify particles small enough to likely pass through human tissues, and they can study the chemistry behind the microplastics they find.
The chemistry of that particle, how does that interact with the chemistry of a human being?
She says that understanding is missing from much of existing microplastics research. Ultimately, Barker says they aim to get their lab accredited for microplastics testing. That would allow Alaska communities to send in water samples to test for microplastics. Barker says testing water sources is the first step in understanding how communities could protect themselves from the tiny plastic particles. In Whittier, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
Native Americans are more likely to develop Alzheimer's disease or other dementias than white or Asian Americans. And because tribal members are already at risk of being murdered or going missing, it means having culturally sensitive resources when elders stray from home, as KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports.
Megan Dickin is from the United Houma Nation in Louisiana and with the nonprofit International Association for Indigenous Aging. She recently presented a new toolkit, which aims to help when Native elders wander.
It's very customizable, and so every community can utilize it in a way that suits them, and we encourage that.
Dickin says tribal police departments are often the first responders.
But a lot of times law enforcement is stretched thin. They don't have enough officers, or they don't have enough resources, or they have other crimes happening. So it can aid in community policing.
Her group says 80% of people with dementia will wander from home multiple times, while 90% may die if they are not found within 24 hours.
When they pass on, a lot of times that knowledge disappears. And we certainly don't want that to die with them prematurely because they went wandering and were not found in time.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kohonic Broadcast Corporation, funded by the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Coming up in a little bit, we're going to hear about the new Vogue boss. That'll be coming up in just a bit. I'm Andrew DeZingel. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show, and here with me right now is the one and only Heather Johnson.
Probably not the one and only. Probably not even in Bemidji.
I don't know about that. I've never met a Heather Johnson in this town besides you.
No, did I tell you my story about garage sailing?
No.
There was one weekend I literally met two other Heather Johnsons.
Wow.
Just out garage sailing. And we decided to form a club. And then, in typical Heather Johnson fashion, we never did. So.
Oh.
Oh, I know. It's disappointing.
What would you have done?
Just Heather stuff. Secret.
Like what? What's Heather?
No, oh. It's secret.
It's a Heather
secret.
Thing you wouldn't understand?
It's a Heather thing.
So we're here until 9 o'clock, and then we're going to hand things over to Headwaters. And in about an hour, we're going to be joined by Steve Call talking about the Marley Call exhibit that will be opening at the Tally Gallery tomorrow afternoon. And yeah, and then, of course, talking all things Riverfest.
Absolutely. Oh, like our question of the week. So since we're getting ready for Grand Rapids Riverfest on Saturday, let us know. Have you been to Riverfest? Tell us about it or other live concerts you went to because you heard the bands on KAXE KBXE. You can text us at 218-326-1234. We'd love to hear from you. And yeah, how about you, Andrew? I bet I know your top band. From Riverfest.
It's got to be Spoon. I've seen them three times.
And they referenced your cool article that you and Malachi wrote last year.
Yes, that is true. That's probably the highlight for me of all the Riverfests I've been to because that was so cool. I never thought it would happen.
I know. And I was just like, what?
Daniel read something I wrote? Wow.
That was so awesome. Yeah.
So, and then also, this doesn't count because I haven't seen them since they were at Riverfest, but the new S.G. Goodman album.
Yeah.
Like, I kind of was aware of S.G. Goodman before Riverfest, but now that having seen them live, like, now I'm paying attention when they release new music.
Yeah.
And the new album's terrific.
It is very good. And when I heard S.G. Goodman on the air, I was like, ooh, this voice. I just loved her. And love the album, and then seeing her in person, it was just like, oh my gosh, she's so cool. So, like, top of my radar now. She was in Duluth not that long ago, and I wish I could have gone to see her again, but I know I'll see her again in concert sometime.
Yeah, so I've already predicted on the air a couple times that I think Jeremy Albino is going to be the one that's going to be like the SG Goodman of this year, where I think they're really going to blow people away at Riverfest this Saturday. Yeah.
I think so too, and he has some really, really fun stuff too. I wasn't really aware of him too much before this year, like in spring. Mm-hmm. But everything I've heard has been great, and he has some. He did an album with Cat Clyde that I really enjoy. There's a Bob Dylan cover on there and some other good stuff. But it's a really good collaboration. So
cool!
I'm excited to see him in person.
Yeah, so that'll be going on this weekend along with Courtney Barnett, Margo Price, and Alan Sparhawk. Margo Price, of course, just released the new album, and it is our album of the week, Hard-Headed Woman, which I always get because there's the Cat Stevens song, Hard-Headed Woman.
Is there?
Do you know that song?
I don't, and I love Cat Stevens.
I feel like there's one that's called that. Maybe I need to look that up. I also think of Kiss's Hard Luck Woman. That Peter Criss wrote.
Baby Till You Find a Man, yeah.
Wow, I didn't know you knew that deep of a Kiss cut.
Oh, that's not a deep cut. Come on.
That's a deep cut. Come on.
Not if you're old like me, it's not.
Well, man is only daughter.
Child of the water. Come on. We could do this all day.
Too proud to be a queen.
Oh, no. But we got to talk about Margo, not Kiss.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Focus.
But I really enjoyed that single. I haven't heard the whole album yet, but the single, it came out a couple weeks ago.
The one Jesse Wells?
It's really
don't
salty.
Don't Wake Me Up. I enjoyed that song.
Not that one.
Oh, Don't Let the Bastards Get You Down?
Yeah. And I heard the unedited version first.
Okay.
Marco's a little spicy.
So we'll be talking more Riverfest this morning, but we want to hear from you right now. Text 218-326-1234. What is your Riverfest memories? We would love to hear from you this morning. And now we're going to hear more from Morning Edition.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. It's official. Chloe Mel will be Vogue's next top editor, taking over from longtime editor-in-chief Anna Wintour. So what does this mean for the publication? To help answer that question, we've called Amy Odell. She's a fashion and culture journalist who wrote Anna, the biography about Anna Wintour. Anna, welcome. I'm sorry, Amy, welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about Chloe Mel, and why do you think Wintour picked her for the job?
Yeah, so if you look at the history of Vogue successions, they tend to pick someone who has had experience working at Vogue, and Chloe Mel is no different. She has a long career in journalism. She's contributed to many publications. She went to Brown. She studied comparative literature. And she started working at Vogue as the social editor in 2011. That was coverage that Anna has always been keenly interested in. So think weddings, think fashionable party coverage. She also wrote the recent cover story about Lauren Sanchez's wedding to Jeff Bezos. And she worked her way up to being the editor of Vogue's website. I would say she's Vogue's first real digital native editor, which is momentous and historic, and it's sort of amazing. It's only just now coming, but she really has a lot of experience that qualifies her for the job, and she's a known entity to Anna and within Condé Nast.
You know, I think people have focused on her celebrity sort of origins. Her father's the director, Louis Malle, her mom is Candice Bergen, who coincidentally played Vogue's editor-in-chief on Sex and the City. But so the celebrity universe is nothing new to her, but what I think I hear you saying is that sort of that internal work your way up connection was really what was dispositive here.
Yeah, I mean, connections certainly help you at Vogue. That is absolutely true. And Chloe Mel definitely knows her way around a red carpet. But Condé Nast tends to put people in this job who have had experience. Anna herself, she worked at Vogue as creative director beginning in 1983. She then became the editor-in-chief of British Vogue. Then she became the editor-in-chief of House Garden, which she renamed HG, before she became editor-in-chief of American Vogue in 1988. And if you go back in history, there haven't been that many Vogue successions, amazingly, but if you go back in history, you see that all the editors-in-chief really had a lot of experience before they got that job.
So what's your sense of what's next for Vogue under her direction?
Well, she has talked about actually cutting back on the number of print issues that Vogue did and doing those issues more around themes instead of months, which seems like a way perhaps to appeal to advertisers. It could perhaps make those issues stand out more online. I think it will be fascinating to see how she distinguishes her Vogue from Anna's Vogue, because Anna is staying on. So how much is she really going to be able to break from Anna's very, very strong aesthetic? The other thing that distinguishes Chloe Mel is that her background is in journalism, whereas Vogue's previous editors have pretty much all had backgrounds in styling. And that's Anna's background as well. She's really more of an image maker. She's not a writer or a journalist.
Well, how do you think the dynamic between them is going to play out, as briefly as you can?
Yeah, all I know is that they have a really great working relationship, and they have both said that Chloe is going to have the opportunity to distinguish her magazine from Anna's. Her first print issue is supposed to come out next year, so I think at that point we'll be able to see what the aesthetic difference is.
That is Amy Odell. She's a fashion and culture journalist. Her latest book is Gwyneth, a biography of Gwyneth Paltrow. Amy, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Morning Edition here on the Wednesday Morning Show, KAXE, KBXE, People Power Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle, and I'm here with Heather Johnson.
Hey, good morning.
We receive support from the Grand Rapids Farmers Market, open Wednesdays and Saturdays from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the intersection of Golf Course Road and Pocagama Avenue, offering an EBT double match and many more programs, bringing produce to members of our community. More at grfarmersmarket.org.
And support for KXE comes from the Pines Restaurant in downtown Grand Rapids, hosting a late-night patio party until 1 a.m. immediately following Riverfest, featuring Asian street food, handcrafted cocktails, and more. Restaurant info available at thepinesmn.com.
And we receive support from the Watermark Arts Center in downtown Bemidji with exhibits, classes, and handcrafted original art made by regional artists found in their Shop 505. The center is accessible and open to the public. WatermarkArtsCenter.org. And in a little bit, we're going to hear a tune from Fox Warren. But first, I wanted to talk about National Day today.
Oh, no. All right.
So I wanted to get your... It's a very short list this week. Okay. So don't get too excited.
I was very excited. Let me be excited.
No.
Oh, fine.
So here's the two we got. I don't know what this is, so I'll get your opinion on it.
Okay.
It's National Welsh Rarebit Day. Do you know what a rarebit is?
I think so. It's a cheese sandwich, isn't it?
Yeah. What is? It's a cheesy toast, originally called rabbit in a tongue-in-cheek way in the Welsh language, because there is no rabbit in the meal.
No, it's like a vegetarian option.
It's toast that has hot cheese poured over it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, looks, I like cheese and I love
cheese
toast.
Cheese and bread. I mean, you can't really go wrong unless maybe like you're vegan or lactose intolerant.
Yes.
Or gluten intolerant.
So you're a pro rarebit?
Absolutely. I am firmly, staunchly pro rarebit.
Excellent.
I'm going to make myself a button that says so.
Excellent. And then we also have U.S. Bowling League Day. Are you currently in a bowling league?
I am not. I've never been in a league. I enjoy bowling. I have kind of a tricky shoulder at the moment, but I like bowling. And we, as a family, have bowled a lot, and usually do in the winter.
What's your score, around 290?
No. No. So much like with any other sport, I really enjoy participating, but I am not very good. So, yeah, I mean, I'll get a few strikes per game, but I'm not fantastic.
Can you do the curve thing?
No, but I think if I had, I don't have like a custom bowling ball or anything. I think if I had a ball with, because I have like tiny child hands. if I had an appropriately sized bowling ball, I think I could, because I've watched other people do it, and I think I could master it.
I had a buddy who could do the curve thing, and I just could not. I cannot do it. I just try to throw it hard and as fast as possible.
Yeah.
In hopes that impact will cause them all to fall down.
Yeah, and I love watching the league people who are really good, and I try not to stare, but also it's so neat to watch them do these cool combos, and it's like, wow, how did you figure that out in your head so quickly and then just execute it? It's fantastic. Love it.
So you're a bowling fan, pro
yes,
bowling.
Absolutely.
Well, it's a huge day for you then.
Yeah.
It's National U.S. Bowling League Day and National Welsh Rarebit Day.
And those two things, as you all know, go together. Perfectly.
I don't think so, because then your hands get all cheesy and then you put it in the bowling ball. That's not good, Heather. What are you thinking?
The bowling place serves pizza. I would also like to let you know that I hope you didn't miss it, but on Monday it was National Ginger Cat Day.
Oh.
So we did celebrate at home a little bit.
And how'd you celebrate?
Just by petting the orange cat.
And about the
shunning,
other cat?
Shunning the tuxedo. No. He likes to be shunned.
He likes it. How do you know that?
He doesn't like a lot of attention.
But the orange cat does.
Orange cat does, yes.
Excellent. What's the orange cat's name?
Stubert.
Stubert. Little Stew, they call him.
Little Stew, yep.
So let us know, what do you think of bowling or Welsh rarebit? Have you had a Welsh rarebit? I've never had one. Have you had one, Heather?
Actually, Welsh? That I don't know. Minnesota version for sure.
Okay. Yeah. I've never seen one before.
You've never seen one?
No, a rarebit. I've never seen one before. I would love to hear your rarebit stories. You can text us at 218-326-1234. And while we're waiting for your text, we're going to play a tune for you. This is from the new album by Fox Warren. It's called Two. The song I'm going to play for you is called Deadhead.
Another day. Another day to start all over again. I
And that was Fox Warren with the song Deadhead from their new album, 2. You were kind of grooving to that music, Heather.
I liked it a lot.
Yeah, so that's the new album from Fox Warren. That band is a Canadian quintet fronted by Andy Schaaf, second album from the band.
They're Canadian, that's why. I love Canadians.
Yeah, you love the Tragically Hip, Canada's most important band?
I mean, yeah.
Over Rush, you would say.
Yeah, probably.
Wow.
I like Rush a lot, too. I listened to 2112 on repeat for like a year.
A year? Wow.
14 was complicated. Hey, yeah. We got a text.
Yes, we got a text. What are we talking about?
Well, Siri let us know that this will be her fourth River Fest. She says, as I work through my first week with an empty nest, I'm thinking of Riverfest last year with both of my kids, as well as dancing with one of my elementary students to Sarah Giroux. It was a fantastic event, and she can't wait until Saturday. Thank you so much for letting us know, Siri.
That's very nice.
That empty nest, that is a hard transition, I think, for a lot of people. It seems weird to be, and it's coming in a few years for me as well. So
I'm trying to think of what will be the most dance-friendly artist this weekend. I think it would be Margot Price. She's got that little bit of a, kind of that little do-do-do. You know?
Well, Courtney, too, you know, I think there's a lot of dancey potential. Alan Sparhawk, he was playing when he was here for Block Party. He was playing some Can.
Yeah, he was playing like kind of a funk set when he was here for the Block Party.
Yeah, so you just never know. I mean, I think it's a dancey day, so bring your comfy shoes.
Let the music play.
Exactly.
You won't get away.
And you'll be warming everyone up, right, with Kiss covers?
Yeah. Well, as I'm driving the bands around, I'm sure they'll enjoy me singing Kiss songs to them.
Oh my gosh, will you do that, please, and record it?
You guys ever heard of Hard Luck Woman? You guys ever think about covering that one?
I'm going to sing it until we reach our destination and then all the way back.
All right, here we go.
I think you might lose your gig.
Yeah, so I better be careful.
I suppose. That's